My name is Attilio Cantori. I'm the music director for the New York City Prisons.
And mine is Philip Young, musician, person, and ex-inmate, I guess. Yeah. How are you?
Okay. How are you, Phil? Tell me what's happening. What are you doing in the streets?
Oh, wow. I've done a lot of, you know, studio work lately, you know, and right now I'm involved with a review, a comedy team, you know, Fat Man and Nanny, you know, it's a comedy thing with a seven-piece band, male vocalist and female vocalist, you know, and everything's been pretty nice. It's a pleasure, you know, to play here and not there, you know. Speaking of playing, you know, if you can remember, there was one particular, you know, time in, well, let's say, oh, I'd say about 2 years ago, if you remember, when Martin Luther King died, we did a particular tune. Do you remember?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was right, that was a powerful experience. I remember when you played drums in it, I played flute. Pip Harris kind of wrote the song and sang it. You remember the tension that was felt in the prison at the time?
Yes, a lot of tension, a sense of
despair almost. Where do we go from here? The song itself reminded me of a kind of coiled spring, ready for a whole new era. We played it throughout the prison, in a prison chapel, so
in
Reverend Pearl's.
Right.
I'd like to hear that now.
Yeah, it would really, you know, bring back a lot of memories.
Sometimes I wish that I was never born because of my skin color.
Wasn't that a gas? Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember there was one part that you were doing there after they said Martin Luther King. You would repeat it on the cymbal or on the drum.
Yeah, that was my escape. Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
You told me the other day when we heard it that you really didn't feel Martin Luther King as much as you felt.
Let me out. Yeah.
Let me out of here. Let me out of here.
Yeah.
That kind of feeling of, well, the concrete and steel.
And bars.
Bars holding you in.
You know, and tin soldiers.
Yeah. And not musical bars, you know.
Mm.
Although, come to think of it, aren't musical bars kind of confines, too? And aren't you, when you're playing drums, dig it, somewhat tyrannical in that you keep a rhythm, and each bar is very solid?
I dig those bars, as you speak of, as more or less tracks, like you would find a train on a track, you know, mm-hmm. going a specific way, going a direction,
yeah.
a strong and straight road, you know, that you're going, but like it's flexible in a sense because there are little sidings and things that you can go, you know, but yet and still you end up that one place, you know, that beautiful place, you know, like the climax or whatever.
Yeah, there's a direction, certainly, and there's no direction
there's
in
definite
the,
direction.
Not enough direction in prisons as such, that's for sure, those bars. Just
wow.
They keep out. But, I'm thinking, though, you know, maybe that's why Rikers is still such a fertile place in that it produces so much real art, real poetry. The repressive nature of the, well, maybe the whole ghetto system, Rikers itself, the prison system, lends that urge, that cry for freedom to
Well, it's
happen.
Understandable that manure and is the most fertile place. You know,
right.
fertile.
But, you know. But somehow it lends this cry to freedom, these bars, this very tight, tense chain of the drum itself in jazz,
yeah.
the chain of the guitar playing its blues structures. Well, it's just that all I know is the poetry, the art, the painting, the music that comes from some place like Rikers constantly gasses me. It has a certain freshness because it has a cry for freedom that is so essential to art.
Right, because I can remember as, you know, like I would say maybe 5 years ago, I really wasn't interested in poetry, you know, until, you know, I was there and I realized that there was so much poetry and so much beauty, you know, with these supposedly, you know, criminal-type people, you know. Like, these are, you know, the people who have committed the worst crimes, so, you know, it's been said, you know. But, like, there was a poem, I think, that you played for me, you know. I think you taped it a couple of days ago, and you played it for me by, I think, an inmate by the name of Smith. I don't
know. Yes. Yeah. But I have it right here. I'd kind of like you to hear it again.
Oh, it would be beautiful. You know, I think the world should hear it, you know, really.
Two men in me. Deep in the moody soul of me lurks the man I'll never be. Narcotic cotton in my ears, not to hear his pitiful cries. No peace have I had in all my years. The eternal man never dies. In prison I forgot how to feel. My soul lay petrified in brick and steel. I projected that man on the screen of my being. Words alone can't describe the horror of seeing a man as good as Jesus Christ, desecrated and made evil by the struggle of life. He lay naked like a clam without his tough shell, a man too fragile for life in hell. He who would glory at every flower's birth, open and helpless to the hurts of the earth. He who would paint or be a poet earned his comrades abuse for daring to show it. The sensitive fool who would not be stilled, let free by me, but to be killed. He who would live a noble life, released in the birthplace of conflict and strife, at the bottom of life, near the surface of death, The good man in the ghetto struggled for breath, slowly transformed by environment. The good man died, then helpless and spent. My mental film ended, and I felt so bad. This grim pressures of life made a good man bad. Now alone in a cell full of endless gray days, the price I must pay for my own evil ways, I watch a lazy seagull go sailing by, and I wish I had wings and was free to fly. Away from the traitor of my own low origin, away from all prisons and this one that I live in. Me with my artificial self trying so hard to be like everyone else. Here in the recess of a makeshift tomb, like a synthetic baby in a concrete womb, I want to be free. God, help me be me, tossed and turned in a tempest of living, made to take instead of giving. Looking out from a mask made of hatred and ice is the me that would like to be nice. Suffering in the silence, a lethal blow from the circumstance of existence that makes it so. Holding tight to a vision that makes me proud. My soul is battered yet unbowed. Above and beyond my mortal body, pure and free of all cheap and shoddy, waiting a chance to be one with me, poor brave man that I'll never be.
Two men and me. Wow.
There's tremendous power in that. You know, it makes me think. Remember a couple of years ago, we discussed a book that was out, Jean-Paul Sartre.
Saint-Genet,
yes.
Yeah.
Jean Genet, the great playwright, was a fantastic poet, but as a child, he was an illegitimate child, was put into a foster home for a short while, and as a little five-year-old, he reached up, as any normal five-year-old boy would do, and reached up to the cookie jar. And as he was reaching for the cookie, his foster mother screamed, "Thief!" And, well, just chased him out of there, sent him, in fact, back to the orphanage that he came from. After all, this no good blood, the right. Son of a prostitute.
Because he stole a cookie.
Right. He now had a new label, that label of a thief. Now, he was going to now play this new role. And remember, Jean-Paul Sartre mentions, as playing this new role, he becomes metamorphosized into a kind of ugly creature that society wants him to be. He is bad because society wants him to be bad. And, well, it's explained, why does society need bad people?
I think the prison officials read that book also, because they do that very well, you know, how they tend to make you feel as if you are the lowest on earth. And we have no right to make anyone feel like they're the lowest on earth, you know. You think, how low is that?
But it's a need that I suppose all of society has. His badness, somehow, was exactly what they wanted.
Which
therefore,
made
it made him a martyr, made him good. And so being the epitome of evil was really being as good as he could possibly be.
Right.
And he was doing exactly what he was expected to do. Hence the title of the book, Saint-Genet.
Right. You know, I can remember growing up, I grew up in a Catholic family, and I can remember it was compulsory in a sense, you know, not with just with the family, but, you know, I went to a parochial school, and it was everyone's dream to one day say a prayer, and the particular saint that you prayed to would be there. Mm-hmm. And, like, it never happened for me, but, well, it didn't happen then, but I feel it happened in that time that I was over there, you know, in Rikers Island, because all of these fellows are there for, you know, these terrible crimes, as Saint-Genet came a saint, you know, by being so very wrong, I said, you know. And, like, I think this is when I met all of the saints, you know, the really beautiful saints, you know, the guy who did the dopamine. He really has something inside, you know, it has to be said, you know, he just never learned how, Uh-huh. You know, he never had time to learn. He was too busy trying to find other things, you know. It's weird, and it bugs me a lot of times. It's really depressing. I think, you know, the best way for the people who are listening right now to try, you know, just to try to imagine how it would feel to wake up one morning and to have someone, you know, standing over them saying, "You're no longer Philip Young or whoever. You're now 466315, and you have to react as such. You know, you have no more to say. You only speak when spoken to. You know, you eat when I tell you to eat. You have no right to be hungry after we fed you, you know, what we feed you. You have no right to want to go to the bathroom until we give you permission. You have no right to get up early in the morning because we'll think you're trying to escape. If we catch you looking out of the window at 5 in the morning, you're going to think you're trying to escape." You know, all of these type of things is really a bad feeling. Like, I've always been the type of person, you know, where I feel strong. I like to fight against these things. And when a person tells you this, you know, tells you, well, you're nobody. You're no one. You're just a number. It's hard to explain, you know, what it takes out of you. It's just a fight in itself, you know, just to stay there and to think. It's hard to think, and they make it very possible for you so that you don't have to think. You know, they give you TVs, and you find that they'd rather you watch cartoons, you know.
Well, I think, though, the cartoons are there for you, and everybody sort of is mesmerized by it because they don't really want to think. It's kind of, well, kind of rough, kind of uncomfortable to think.
Yeah. I like to know, man. Like, I never asked you. It's weird because we were very close in the prison, but there was always the fact that you were Mr. Cantore, and I couldn't, you know, get too carried away because I'd never know what kind of attitude you have, you know. I didn't go home with you last night or the night before, and I would never know what type of feelings you had, and if I said something to you that might have would have offended you. But there was a possibility I might have ended up in the Bing, even though, you know, I thought that I knew you well enough that you wouldn't do this. Yeah. But I couldn't take that chance, you know. Now you're just Attilio. But tell me, as a person working within the prison, as a white man, and as a human being, how do you feel, you know, and what do you think should be done about getting music, art, and all of these things to the people, and not just, you know, particular groups of people? Because this is what's happening now is it's the only persons coming in contact with music is the band, because they're there to play.
You mean on the island?
Yeah. On the island, yeah. You know, but like, I'm speaking about getting it to everyone, you know.
On the island.
On the island, yeah. And they have little shows come over occasionally, but they're not really in tune with themselves. And I think music and art and all of these things, you know, really get you in tune with yourself, you know. What do you think should be done about how can we get to them? This is what's important to me, getting to them.
Well, I suppose this is the reason why I'm there at all. Let me tell you a little bit why I got interested in it. I once ran an importing, exporting musical instrument company, and I repaired instruments. And I also played concerts at Town Hall and Carnegie Hall and solo recitals, this kind of thing. Then somehow it didn't mean that much. Taking a bow at a concert all by itself, the applause was soon forgotten. Well, now, what did I really do? What am I really doing? It's still a problem with me. Is music by itself disassociated from a whole social environment, you know, the whole world around me? Can I really do that? Can I live in my ivory tower? Well, I pose these questions to myself. I should do something that is more meaningful. There's just too much of the world around me that perhaps I could do something about. In my own little way. And, the way I knew best was with music. And, well, one day I received a contract for a repair of instruments when I took bids back in my days from a prison, you know. This was kind of strange. And, well, I brought the instruments to the prison after I had finished fixing them, repairing them, and won a bid on it. And I was gassed with what I saw. I saw the band there under Mr. Eddie Ruperto, great little man. Some of the greatest jazz musicians in the country were up there playing. They were on for drugs and whatever reasons, you know, narcotic charges. Were up there in a band. The greatest all-star band one could ever imagine was standing up there playing. And
yeah, I remember.
I was really gassed by this. I decided, well, this is really what I want to do, work with some of these guys. And, well, when I first came, I kind of, well, soon became music director of the place, and I'd sort of humbly bring my flute along and say, man, could I play with you? You know, I have the honor. Because they really commanded that much respect as musicians, as people. And, well, I hope I haven't lost that respect for all of the men there.
No, by no means have you lost the respect. What's keeping you there now? Like you told
what's keeping
you there now? What are you trying to do?
Because I found that not just the jazz musicians that were there were worthwhile, but some of the kids that never played an instrument in their life were worthwhile. And I really got to know them, found out how terrific they were, how much potential they had. Well, people like you who hardly played drums before you came in. Some kids that are working now, very busy, making albums, never played a horn before they came there.
Mm.
And, well, it was just fantastically rewarding to see a man whose life was almost condemned to going in and out of prisons, to suddenly somehow sidetrack that and go on to his own thing and do it in the way he knew best, in music. Unfortunately, there aren't enough guys who can really become great musicians. I don't expect to make a world of great musicians, but I think that if I've helped some of them just find meaning through music, find a meaning in life, that's worthwhile. You know, there are a lot of kids that went out and still had to do their portering. But if they were a porter, now they were a musician who was just portering temporarily, and with enough money maybe to get to music school or to work on weekends, hope to work on weekends. But it was a new identity, and it had meaning. They would have never poured it that long, scrubbed floors and taken all of that abuse, if they had nothing but that identity, just a porter.
Or ex-inmate.
Or ex-inmate, which certainly is a label which prevents them from getting anything else in almost any field. Music is one field where, well, sometimes it's even a badge of honor, because Rikers Island is probably one of the greatest jazz schools in the country.
Yeah.
There's so much soul there. There's so many good musicians there. And we somehow constantly exchange beautiful ideas, musically, poetically, artistically.
I've heard some of the best musicians I've ever heard over there. You know, there's one musician over there now in particular which you remember and you know quite well. I don't want to mention his name, but he's a pianist. I mean, if you know who I'm speaking about.
Right.
And like this guy is a fantastic pianist, but he's only able to stay, you know, in the street for like 8 days or more or less.
Mm-hmm.
No more.
Yeah.
Very less, you know. And these things bother me. You know, this is why, you know, like, I think this is what I'm here for, you know, try to do something about it. You know, I want to see.
What was it? He had hoped to go to his aunt's house when he got out because his mother and father didn't want to know him. He was no good criminal, you know.
He was no good to his aunt, but she just had a change of heart, and she felt guilty, I guess.
But she didn't keep him for long either.
No, she put him through a change as soon as he came home.
Sure. So he had to wander and go nowhere, no place
And
to
the
go.
Depressing thing was that I had gotten an appointment for him to go to a particular studio here in New York, you know, to work as a studio pianist. And he wasn't out here long enough to make the appointment. You know, he came by my house, I think, like 2 days after he got out. We discussed it. We spent the whole day and most of the night together. And I took him around, showed him, you know, different spots and whatnot. And I think you told me. You know, I think I was supposed to do it. I think I was supposed to work with him.
We were supposed to work a thing together at St. Peter's.
Right, because I was leaving. I was coming back
Lutheran
from
Church,
Florida.
We were going to do a jazz vespers there. And
Washington.
It turns out that after, 8 days, I think, he was back in. So I had to hire another pianist right away. It was Maurice Waller, remember?
This is blood. This is parents doing these things to people. You know, some of these fellas. You know, I'm not going to blame parents completely, but they can help also. You know, just like the fella, he can help himself too. You know, I'm not saying that the inmate should be patted on the head, you know, and grabbed by the hand and led along. It's a lot of little things, you know, that can help. You know, a letter from his wife. You know, he's a man. You know, like I've heard a lot of stories. You know, I stole because I wanted to give my wife everything.
Yeah.
And 6 months later, they gave me 3 years, and 6 months later, my wife writes me and tells me I found someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, what was all this for? What did I steal for? You know, and she went to somebody else, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and these things are depressing. And all of this, I think, you know, I got over it, you know, all of these type of things through music. You know, music is like a beautiful... it's like being somewhere else, you know.
It's like
being somewhere else.
World,
you know, I think I used to tell you that when I play those drums, man, and I see it, you know, I see this beautiful woman, you know. And like she has nothing at all, you know, and I have the power to give her everything, you know. A rim shot here will make a beautiful earring. A flammacue here will give her a mink stole or just a plain dress to cover herself, you know. Whatever, you know. And, like, after I've played a particular piece, you know, if you ever notice, you know, I would sit back on the stool and look at the chick now, you know, and see, you know, did I, if I
Is
played
that what
well.
You're looking at each time and staring. Yeah. Oh, okay.
You know? You know, I'd look and say, well, did I clothe her? Did I give her everything? If, you know, if I feel that I gave her everything, then I'm satisfied with the way I played, you know. You know, so far I haven't...
You tipped me off, I'd have looked too.
Yeah, man, you know, but the thing was, you know, a lot of times, you know, she didn't have shoes or something, you know. Uh-huh. And then, I felt that I'd have to practice a little more. Yeah. But eventually, you know, I'll give her everything that she has to have. You know, one of these days.
You have been listening to Analog, a radio series we present in cooperation with the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Our guests were Attilio Cantore, music director for the New York City prisons, and Philip Young, jazz drummer and former inmate of Rikers Island. On each of these analog broadcasts, we have asked the participants to share something with us that has guided them and might be considered food for thought. Today, Philip Young told us, people have to realize that thinking is a very beautiful thing. It's a privilege. If people can just sit down a few minutes a day and think about the reasons for being on the earth, for living and dying, we'll all be a lot better off. And Attilio Cantore asked us to call again to mind the musical composition Martin Luther King we heard at the opening of the program. Fred Facey speaking. This recorded program, produced by Rhoda Grady and directed by Albert Reyes, has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.